This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the middle of a North Philadelphia neighborhood that's become famous for drug trafficking and drive-bys is a Quaker cemetery known as the Fair Hill Burial Ground. There lie Lucretia Mott, the abolitionist and feminist, Robert Purvis, who was known as the president of the Underground Railroad, and other abolitionists and 19th-century reformers. In 1985, long after the Quakers had moved out of the neighborhood, they sold the burial ground and meeting house to a Baptist church. The change coincided with the rise of crack. The burial ground was trashed and vandalized and became a haven for drug users and dealers. Neighbors complained, and in response, the Quakers formed a group to buy back and, with the help of the community, clean up the cemetery. My guest Marianne Hunter is the president of the Fair Hill Burial Ground Corporation, which is leading the restoration effort. I asked her when the Quakers decided to take back the burial ground.
Well, probably 5 or 6 years ago, the state of the burial ground was very distressing to Margaret Bacon, the biographer of Lucretia Mott, a local Quaker. And she began to talk to any and all who were interested and stirred up a group of us to see what we could do. So there was a kind of predecessor project where one of our members spent a year or more in the neighborhood trying to understand what the organizational capacities were, what the interests, what the concerns were, and how we might re-enter that picture in a constructive way. And then during that time, we began the process of negotiation to see if we might buy the burial ground back, because it seemed like, in the end, that was going to be the practical way to address the problem.
What was the ambition when the Quakers decided to buy it back?
Just to restore the property to some useful function in the neighborhood. I think some people had visions of it being possibly a very active center or a spot for recreation. Others just saw it as a historical burial ground, and other people wanted kids to be able to visit Lucretia Mott's grave. So we've been kind of feeling our way to see what of that is achievable and what makes sense and what fits with what the neighborhood wants to do.
Tell me about your first trip to the burial ground. When was it? What state was it in?
Oh, it was a kind of late fall Sunday, and my husband and I drove up after meeting. And it was both wonderful and distressing. It was a very peaceful, bright, sunny day, and you could just drive right into the burial ground. It's a beautifully laid out place with a sort of oval design to the main cartways, and it has old trees and lots of, and at that time the vegetation is kind of not as rampant as it is during wet and hot periods. And at the same time, the neighborhood was very scary because of everything I'd heard about it. On subsequent visits, I think as I became more acquainted with the stories and understood what was happening there and saw the active drug market, I think the fear factor increased for me. But that first visit, I was impressed with what a resource it really was, a whole city block there that was basically trees and, at that time, maybe in some parts like 8-foot-high vegetation, but it had the potential of being a serene, green place.
I'm wondering if you and the other Quakers felt an almost personal sense of violation because there were so many drugs getting sold on the site of Lucretia Mott's grave and other graves of people who have been historically very important in the Quaker community.
I think distress was more my sense in response to that. It's distressing to see people's lives in such disarray and so hopeless and strung out. So that when you see people in that condition, I think distress is what you can feel. The state of the property was very upsetting. And I'm just one of those people that sort of likes to get things back in order. So I think those were the major, like, what do we do about this? How can we make this, fix this up?
Would you tell us a little bit about the Quaker idea of death and burial and the role of a cemetery in the life of the neighborhood that it's in or the lives of the people with family buried there?
Well, Quakers don't see burial grounds as hallowed ground in the same way that many religious groups do. So we're quite comfortable using it for what we think is appropriate. Many of us who grew up as friends experienced being in a friend's school right next to the burial ground and kind of seeing it as an extension of our school grounds, wandering about there. I mean, you want to treat it respectfully, but we don't see it as that special. And in early times, they didn't even mark the graves. That became a later addition. It was considered somewhat ostentatious. So there's still a sense of, let's use this ground in ways that make sense for a community and respect the people that are buried there and their living relatives who want to pay respects or know that the place where their remains are is well cared for. But it's about the living. I mean, we need to be responsive to that.
Well, you're the president of the group that's trying to restore the cemetery. Why is this project so important to you?
Good question. I think it, both for itself, I really like the place and I like the people that I've gotten to know there. I think it's kind of an experiment, though. It's like, what can people who live in suburban or urban settings but are not in such distressed states do about those that are? How can we respond to these conditions? And what can we learn from this one experiment about what we can do more widely in the city? And I think a lot of the people that come there to work on it are very gratified by that opportunity to do something real and concrete where they can see at the end of a couple of hours of volunteer labor with other people what they've accomplished. I mean, it's concrete. And they can feel that this does really make a difference to the neighborhood. And I think the neighbors are reflect that back to us. We appreciate that you're taking care of your property. We value you as a neighbor. And that's kind of how we've looked at it, as being responsible stewards of property.
What kind of connections have you made with the residents of the community that the cemetery is in and the activists within the community?
Well, the first resident I met was Elizabeth Gutierrez, who lives with her husband, three boys, and a young daughter, right on the south side of the burial ground. And she's a very diminutive person, but just full of fire and determination and I don't know if she's fearless, but she faces a great deal on a daily basis in terms of things that would make most people fearful. She worked with us on the sort of predecessor project where we're looking at what can we do. And she grew up in that neighborhood, so she had visions and memories of how the neighborhood functioned in an earlier time, its communality, how much the burial ground added to the lives of people in just a very passive way. People walk through it, but they just like looking at it. They could open their windows. They could hear birds sing. They could see roses bloom. So that was really kind of inspiring. And Elizabeth's daily struggles and her valiant efforts are very inspiring as well. Subsequently, I met Peaches Ramos, who is a activist in that neighborhood and has been for many years and has accomplished a great deal. I met Hilda Colon, who works actively with her in the 9th and Indiana Association and lives just on the east side of the burial ground along 9th Street. And Hilda, I initially met on the phone because she'd call and tell me about things that were going on there and urge me to do something about them. So we worked together a lot that way. And then on the northwest corner is the Way to Heaven Ministry, which ministers to recovering addicts, especially those Spanish-speaking ones, from that community but from a much broader area. And the Reverend Rosado and his wife Bonnie do just a wonderful job there. And they have helped us out enormously by providing a sort of litter control around the burial ground, both inside and outside, and being our eyes on the street. So those have been kind of the main anchors in the community, I think, that have been helpful to us.
When the Quakers decided to take back the graveyard and take responsibility for cleaning it up, where'd you start cleaning?
Well, there already was a volunteer group that met on regular Saturdays. So we started to concentrate our energies on those Saturday mornings and kind of space them out, give them some regularity, and concentrate the time during which we cleaned so we'd have a lot of people there. That helped. Pickup was just the first thing we started doing. We took dumpster load after dumpster load out of there of hot water heaters and mattresses and old refrigerators and car fenders. And
people were throwing their old refrigerators into the cemetery?
Well, obviously people don't throw them, so they were backing their trucks in and dumping it off. So that was the other thing that we did immediately. We tried to secure the whole perimeter so truckloads didn't come in. People threw things, too. But, I mean, the main stuff was probably, from my days working in clean city activities, are probably contractors who are looking for a cheap place to dump. And they're not necessarily from that neighborhood. They just look for some place that it doesn't look like anybody's going to do anything to stop them.
So really, the cemetery had become not only a haven for drug dealers, but a junkyard.
Absolutely. And you know, you've probably heard enough about how cleaning and those things work together, that when people see a place that is treated that way, then they feel they can treat it that way, too. So it's cycles.
So the junkier it gets,
yeah, the worse it gets. Feel, yeah.
Right, like,
and conversely, when you start to correct that, people start to amend their behavior also.
Well, do you feel that happened? That
as soon as
you started hauling the junk
absolutely.
Out of the graveyard,
absolutely.
That how did it change behavior of people?
Well, people would stop and tell us they appreciated it. There was a, certainly because we secured the perimeter, that we didn't get the volumes in that we were taking out. So we still got people, things thrown in, dead dogs. I mean, there was a lot of unpleasant stuff, bottles, cans, that kind of stuff. But it diminished in volume. That was probably the first thing. And we always had people who picked up. We started on the Cambria Street side. That somehow, the south side, that somehow felt like the friendlier side to us and kind of worked our way north. And people would comment, people who came, you know, irregularly would say, oh, it looks much better than it did. So we encouraged ourselves in that way.
What were some of the rumors that you heard in the neighborhood before the cemetery was cleaned up about what was really there, what its real history was?
Well, the most persistent rumor is that it's a pet cemetery. And this is persistent and apparently was true a long time ago, even when it was well-maintained. So it's not a question of it's being maintained. I think it's because it has low stones and rather than more elaborate stones. That's the best answer I can give, because when people tell me that, I ask them, gee, what makes you think that and how did you hear it? And that's the best sense I can make of it.
And what connotation does pet cemetery have?
To the people that are supposing that, I think somehow less important or less religious. And also that it's okay to put your dead dogs in there. So.
Right. That's maybe why people were tossing your dead dogs in.
Not a good connotation from our perspective.
My guest is Marianne Hunter. She's the president of the Fairhill Burial Ground Corporation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Marianne Hunter. She's the president of the group leading the effort to clean up a historic Quaker cemetery that was virtually taken over by drug dealers and users. What role would you like the burial ground to play in the future of the community?
Well, I would like it to return to being that place where people can get a sense of serenity and beauty. And whether that's in a passive way by people looking in, I'd rather have us figure out how it can be a more active way so that people can use it for activities that would feel appropriate to them and to us. The work with the kids is wonderful and has been very exciting to our volunteers and our board. And recently, we had someone who was bringing in a group of kids from North Carolina Friends School, down there, New Garden Friends School, to work. So in preparation, he went around on the Indiana side and talked to the dealers there and said, I'm going to be bringing a bunch of school kids in and I'm going to bring them through the gap in the fence that's here for a variety of reasons. Will they be okay? And it was really a very striking conversation that he reported to me, how these people engaged in the drug trade were themselves excited to see kids coming there and doing this work and making it beautiful. So, you know, who knows? It may even affect the people who are most beleaguered there.
Do you feel like this project is changing you at all and exposing you to things that you hadn't been exposed to before?
Yes, I certainly never experienced that intensity of drug dealing. We can be there on a Saturday morning and there can be 50 or more of us working in the burial ground, and there'll be an equally large number of people out at 9th and Indiana hawking their wares, you know, just hollering out what they have available and where to get it. And that, to me, is shocking, that that kind of active drug trade can be happening on a city street on a Saturday morning between 10 and 12, undisturbed. Now, it has been disturbed. I mean, there have been periods where it's really been put in abeyance. But I have to say now it seems to be returning.
The drug trade seems to be returning?
To that area. I don't think it ever went away. It just moved to a different location, but it's moving back into that area now.
When you say that area, do you mean like closer to the cemetery too?
Yeah, the whole 9th and Indiana. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the northern,
right.
9th and Indiana is the mm-hmm. northern boundary of the burial ground. And it was that very, very active there. And then March a year ago, you may remember where there was a batch of bad heroin sold, which killed people right away instead of more gradually. Within, I would say, 48 hours, the drug trade was stopped dead there. Now, most of the credit I give to Peaches Ramos because she had been working for and agitating to get the police mobile unit stationed there during the week, and she succeeded in doing that.
She's a neighborhood activist.
Absolutely. The neighborhood activist, we might even say, although she certainly brings a lot of people along with her. So when that was true, it reduced the drug trade dramatically. But I believe that there must have been other events connected with this bad heroin stuff that also caused that trade to be shut down in that area.
So how discouraging do you find it that the drug trade seems to be returning in spite of your efforts?
Well, I don't think it's in spite of our efforts. I think it's in spite of the neighborhood efforts. I give them the credit for that. I think it's a difficult problem and that we all have to keep working on it. When it was in abeyance, it allowed neighbors on both sides of that street to connect with one another and work actively. They're planting a garden on Hutchinson Street north of Indiana and really strengthen themselves because they could communicate. They could walk out and know each other across Indiana. And that's the most distressing part of it, that if it really becomes active like that, it may halt their efforts to come together and rejuvenate their neighborhood. That would be my biggest concern. It doesn't affect us as people like it does people in the neighborhood. I mean, just so our effort is to try to be part of that neighborhood effort and support it as much as we can. So it's distressing. But in the long haul, I'll put my belief in the neighbors. I think they're going to prevail.
Do you know if there are any people who have family buried in the cemetery who still come and visit the grave?
Oh, yes. And there, Jim Glacken on our board has family members buried there. We've had people who just read about it in the paper that we were doing cleanup and who came to help us out because they have family members buried there. I got a call and a letter from someone who's too elderly to visit now, but she sent me some pictures because I said we're trying to resurrect, you know, a visual history of what the burial ground was. And was this woman as a young girl and the caretaker's daughter. And so there are lots of people who feel a real connection to it, either from living in the neighborhood and or having family members buried there.
Are these people who were afraid to come visit before the cleanup?
Yes.
Maybe they wouldn't even.
Many of them still might be. And we don't encourage people to just kind of come by casually. We say, come when we're doing a cleanup or let us know and we'll meet you there. Or, you know, we try to make it more of an event.
Can you estimate how many members of the community are involved in the cemetery cleanup project?
The local area?
Mm-hmm.
I would guess that among volunteers, there might be maybe 25 people who have helped us off and on. The Julio de Burgos kids regularly come, and oftentimes they bring parents.
It's the middle school kids.
Yes. So that's a good part of that cadre. And then there's a local block captain, and he comes often, and he lives along Indiana, so he keeps an eye from his side. People from Way to Heaven often come, even though they do community service by cleaning up during the week. They sometimes come on Saturdays as well, although that's a busy day for them in the life in their community. So that I might be underestimating, but I would say in that neighborhood.
The neighborhood that the cemetery is in has been nicknamed the Badlands. Largely because of all the drug dealing mm-hmm. that happens in the streets there. What do you think of that nickname?
Oh, the people there hate it. And it reflects that activity. It doesn't reflect the place. Most of the people there are wonderful, solid, law-abiding family people. So we'd like to think that maybe someday the people will think of it as the Fair Hill neighborhood. And I think all of us are working toward that. That might not be the name, but that was a historic name.
That's the name of the burial ground, the Fair Hill burial ground.
But it was also a neighborhood name, and it was derived in part from the Isaac Norris's estate was called Fair Hill. So that was like the lands that were there.
The neighborhood that the cemetery is in remains a very poor and a very violent neighborhood, a neighborhood with a lot of drugs blatantly being sold on the street. It's still a dangerous neighborhood to be in. What do you think the odds are that the cemetery will be a kind of safe place where people can go and reflect on Lucretia Mott or the past, or just the grass and the trees that are there, just to almost have like a little park space to be in? Do you think it can ever be a safe place for people to visit?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I do. Remember, the people that live in that neighborhood, whom we would expect to enjoy it, live with those conditions all of the time. So anything that adds to their sense of enjoyment of their life is a benefit. And they are amazingly tough about how they manage their lives and prevail.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Mary Ann Hunter is the president of the Fairhill Burial Ground Corporation in Philadelphia. In the second half of our show, we'll hear from a teacher, a student, and a neighborhood activist involved in the cemetery cleanup. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.